basically shit. But then he thought of Copano and Ran, the heroic ones. How hard they tried to do good in the world. He thought about how he himself had run away from a bad situation, one caused by his parents, as it happened, to go fight an alien invasion. "You're wrong," he replied, wishing he sounded more certain. "People are better than you give them credit for." She smiled, almost like she was proud that her offspring was capable of such optimistic thought. Her teeth were stained with wine. "And then what will happen," B continued, "is war. A war between those with powers and those without. The end result being either the extinction of legacies, a great loss to humanity, or the subjugation of the non-powered, which, well, not so rosy either way, is it? We in the Foundation believe we can head off these eventualities, but, unfortunately, the first battles are already being fought, and soon it will be too late to reverse course." Nigel squinted at the screen. "What first battles? What are you on about?" "One of yours has already broken the Guard Declaration. He's killed humans in cold blood. Colleagues of mine in the Foundation, their security, anyone who gets in his way." A cold feeling took hold of Nigel. He sensed where this conversation was going. "He killed your father," B continued. "He almost killed you." Nigel gritted his teeth.
"Aina!"
A shadow crossed B's face, as if the boy's very name frightened her. She nodded once.
"He'll come for me, eventually," she said simply. "The security I have here won't be enough to stop him."
Nigel looked away. He said nothing.
"Will you let me die, Nigel? Your own mother?"
Nigel didn't sleep that night. B's words rattled around in his brain. His parents were bad people. Moog Pro rejects. Bloodthirsty capitalists. Murderers. When Nigel was a boy, his father had sent him away as soon as his presence had become inconvenient. After Nigel fled Pepperpont, the old man had never even tried seeking him out. Too busy with the Foundation, probably. He didn't love the bastard. So why did he feel the cold yearning for revenge? "Well," he told himself, "Einar did try to drown me. He owed him for that. Now, his mother only wanted him around to save herself. Or did she still have some repressed maternal affection? She'd been happy to have him saved in Iceland. She'd been watching him sleep. Could he let Einar kill her? And his mother was probably right. Einar's going around slaughtering Foundation people, bad as they were, could set off a war. The psycho would ruin all their lives." Nigel wanted to scream. So he did. After all, the walls were soundproof. That morning, his fourth day in captivity, the door to his room slid open. His mom stood there, hair a bit tousled, cheeks puffy from last night's drinking. There was no team of mercenaries behind her. She was alone, fragile. Nigel could have easily pushed her aside with his telekinesis and made his escape. She must have known that, but she opened the door anyway. B said nothing. She clasped her hands and waited. It was on him. "All right," Nigel said, deciding right then what he would do. "I'll help you." Chapter 25. Caleb Crane, Melbourne, Florida. Caleb's shoulders were starting to burn. With a groan, he rolled over on the blanket and reached for his t-shirt. He pulled it onto his sun-baked torso.
"Ow," he said. "Man, I told you to reapply," Daniela scolded.
She grabbed the tube of sunscreen and tossed it into Caleb's lap.
"Pale ass is gonna look like a lobster out here."
"Yeah," he replied, blowing out a sigh.
"Yeah, you told me."
It was a cloudless day, unseasonably warm, the white-capped waves sending salty spray up on a lazy breeze. The sand shimmered here, the beach pristine, without any other people in sight. Next to Caleb, Daniela reclined on her elbows, her lean body clad in a white bikini, sweat dimpling her abdomen. Caleb should have been enjoying the hell out of this. So why wasn't he? A private beach, all to themselves on Florida's Space Coast, so-called because it was where NASA and any number of defense contractors, including Sidal Corp, were headquartered. Maybe it was their host that bothered him. Maybe that's what kept Caleb from completely turning off his mind and enjoying this unearned vacation. But Mr. Sidal, Wade, he insisted they call him Wade, had been nothing but nice to them. They stayed in guest rooms in his sprawling beachside mansion. He fed the visiting guard lavish meals cooked by his personal chef, showed off his multitude of engineering projects, and let them use the beach and his infinity pool. Massages and tennis lessons were also on offer, although Caleb hadn't partaken in either. It had been almost a week of that pampering, and Mr. Sidal, Wade, asked for nothing in return. Sidal spent most of his time in his technology-filled basement workshop. The gadgets and gizmos in there would have made Dr. Good jealous, Caleb thought. Sometimes he took meetings at the Navy base in the area. He had his own paid security detail. This was a cream puff detail. There was no reason for Caleb to feel so on edge. And yet, he couldn't shake that feeling. Caleb thought about calling his uncle. But what would he tell Uncle Clarence? That Melanie Jackson was a huge wimp who needed a break from Earth Guard life after a week of photo ops and some light construction work? She'd been protected from the worst of the invasion by her president father, had never gone to the academy, and was basically coddled at Earth Guard. Did she really need a vacation from her vacation? Maybe that wasn't the most charitable assessment of Melanie, but it didn't help Caleb's opinion that she mostly ignored him and Daniela, preferring instead to spend her free time video chatting with people from her old life, prep school classmates, senators' kids, future leaders of the free world. No, Lawson wouldn't care about that. That was kid stuff. What did his uncle want him to uncover? A crab scuttled past their blanket, black eyes like twin periscopes swiveling around. The little guys were called ghost crabs. Caleb had first spotted them scampering across the sand a few days ago. Bored and tired of swimming, he'd spent a solid hour reading about them online.
"Check it out," Caleb said, pointing the gold-tinted crustacean out to Daniela. "Those guys changed their colors to blend in with the sand. Pretty cool, huh?"
Daniela tipped down her paperback, some lurid romance novel she'd picked up at the airport, so she could regard Caleb.
"You could learn something from them," she said.
"What's that supposed to mean?" As they watched, the crab buried itself back in the sand, only its pair of elongated eyes visible.
"It means you could try going with the flow a bit," Daniela replied. "I see you over there, wheels turning and shit. You've been sulking around since we got here."
"I'm not sulking," Caleb responded sulkily.
"Don't you just think, I don't know, like, this is weird?" Man, we saved the world from an alien invasion, Daniela replied, her braid shaking back and forth as she laughed. I mean, the Lorik did most of it, but we were there too. They should be giving us free vacations for the rest of our lives. Be like the crab, man. Chill.
I think they blend in like that to avoid predators.
You see any predators out here, Caleb?
Caleb turned his head to look back at the beach house. I don't know. People were starting to gather on the house's back deck. Caleb could see Wade there. The man was supposedly in his 50s, but his baby face and angular black goatee made him look younger. He wore his hair long like a surfer, not a strand of gray in there, just like his beard. In another bout of boredom, Caleb had watched some of Mr. Seidel's TED Talks from before the invasion, where he lectured on the possibility of achieving immortality, physical or digital. It all went over Caleb's head, but just by looking at him and listening to him talk, Caleb could tell the guy wanted desperately to stay young forever. Seidel was surrounded by the usual horde of assistants and interns. All of them were young and attractive, fresh out of Ivy League schools. They mingled with the more professionally dressed research and development reps from various engineering and military concerns. Everyone gathered to watch the day's launch from the comfort of Seidel's estate. Caleb could pick out the military brass from the crowd by their haircuts and rigid postures. For a second, he swore he saw his dad up there. Too much sun. In the middle of it all, of course, was Melanie. Even at a distance, she looked especially vibrant. Her blonde hair flowed loose around her head, the wind plucking at her tennis skirt and blouse. Seidel kept a fatherly arm around her shoulders, introducing her to his various guests. Just like on their missions with Earthguard, Melanie held herself apart from Caleb and Daniela, so much so that he was always surprised to see how easily she turned on the social charms. Waiters circulated through the crowd on the deck, with hors d'oeuvres and cocktails. Caleb and Daniela had been invited to Seidel's little party, but had opted to watch the launch from the beach instead. Crazy that guys like him are still interested in space travel, Caleb said to Daniela. Especially when we know there's nothing really out there. All the aliens are trying to come here.
You're just full of deep thoughts today.
Thanks. A loud chant started on the deck, a countdown from 10. Caleb tipped his sunglasses down to watch the vessel take off. The sleek, silver-plated ship rose up from its launch pad down the beach and cut soundlessly through the perfect blue sky. The aircraft was disc-shaped, like the cliché idea of a flying saucer. Seidel probably thought that was clever. A crimson glow came from the wannabe UFO's underbelly. It looked like it was on fire, but those were actually the thrusters. That was repurposed Mogadorian technology. The military had recovered tons of skimmers after the invasion, and Seidel had been selected as one of the developers to work on reverse engineering it. Today was a big day for Wade and Seidel Corp. They were the first company to get a prototype flight ready. In an effort to distance his work from the hostile aliens that provided its foundation, Seidel had christened the ship the Shepard 1, named for the first American to make it into space. The Shepard 1 swooped around, propelled by its thrusters, stable and under control. It did a loop-the-loop, much to the delight of Seidel's guests. Then the ship went vertical, rising higher and higher, until it was just a silver speck. Caleb lost sight of it. The plan was for the Shepard 1 to reach the exosphere. The crowd on the deck fell silent, huddled around Wade and his tablet that displayed the craft's diagnostics.
"Hope it doesn't blow up," Daniela remarked.
Moments later, A cheer went up from the deck. The Shepherd One had reached the edge of Earth's atmosphere. Soon the ship came back into sight, drifting gracefully back down and onto its launch pad. Everyone applauded. A complete success.
"Cool," Daniela said dryly, barely looking up from her book. "Nice to see we humans have got spaceships now. And it's nice that thing didn't shoot at us, huh?"
Caleb glanced back at the deck where Seidel was getting bombarded with back-patting and handshakes. "Don't you get the feeling that this Seidel guy thinks everything that came from the war, the tech, the blasters, the warships, even us with our legacies, is all just toys for him to play with?" Daniela shrugged.
"What do you want from a nerd like that? He probably reverse-engineered a Rubik's Cube when he was a toddler. And I'm pretty sure Dr. Good does the same stuff."
"It's different," Caleb replied. "Malcolm is trying to help us."
"I'm going to take a nap," Daniela said.
She closed her book, stood up, and gathered her towel.
"Try to chill out, okay, Caleb? No one here is out to get you."
Caleb did not chill out. A few minutes after Daniela left, Caleb stood up and headed back to the mansion. The gathering on the deck was now a full-fledged cocktail party. None of the guests eager to leave behind Seidel's hospitality. No one paid Caleb any attention as he skirted around the side of the house and entered through a side door. During the tour when they first got there, Wade had briefly taken his guard guests by his workshop. It was on the first floor, right across the hall from the gym. Seidel had laughed sheepishly about his geek sanctuary, told Caleb and the others that they'd find his projects boring, and instead guided them into the fitness center, where he had elliptical machines hooked up to VR. Caleb had wanted to poke around the workshop ever since. What better time than now, when everyone else was distracted at the Shepherd One reception? Seidel didn't even keep the room locked. The workshop got plenty of light from its floor-to-ceiling windows, a view of the beach visible beyond. The space was immaculately organized, tools and gears and circuit boards all in their proper places. A half-dozen drones of various sizes sat dormant on a workbench. On a nearby easel were a stack of hand-drawn schematics. Caleb put his hands on his hips. This wasn't exactly an evil lair. It sort of reminded him of Dr. Good's laboratory, although way less chaotic. What had he really been expecting to find? A familiar shape on the topmost schematic caught his eye. With a curious frown, Caleb approached the easel. The technical sketch looked at first like a thumbtack combined with a microchip. Caleb recognized the device as the same one they pulled out of that girl Rabia's temple when they rescued her from the harvesters. An inhibitor. There were handwritten notes in the margins of the sketch, the tidy writing presumably Seidel's. Easily removed, difficult to attach, painful. Caleb flipped to the next page. A human skull was sketched there in perfect detail. One of the inhibitor chips was drawn directly attached to the bone, its little prong penetrating 3.4 millimeters. The exact measurement was scribbled right there, along with a bunch of other calculations that Caleb couldn't make sense of. There were more notes. Highest possible voltage. How much equals too much? Prone to short circuit. Grimacing as he imagined having one of those things stuck directly into his head, Caleb went to the next sketch. This one wasn't nearly as technical as the ones that preceded it. A freehand version of Da Vinci's Vitruvian Man was jotted on the paper in pencil, squiggles of blue highlighter running through the limbs, coalescing in the chest and head. Columns of impenetrable equations spread out from the figure, some of them running up against the edge of the paper. written across the page. Source of lauric energy. Can it be detected? Neutralized? Caleb wished he had a cell phone or a camera. He wondered what Dr. Good would make of these designs.
What are you doing in here?
Caleb jumped at the sound of a woman's voice. It was Lucinda, one of Seidel's many college-aged interns. She was pretty, in her early 20s, with hair the color of nutmeg, a smattering of freckles, and sharp green eyes. She was dressed professionally, a neat skirt and a high-collared blouse. She had a stack of paperwork under her arm. Caleb swallowed. He replied, not sure what to say.
I was just...
Those are all out of date, Wade Seidel said airily, waving at the sketches as he entered the room behind Lucinda. He smiled at Caleb as he set down his tablet, the one that had been monitoring Shepherd One.
Sometimes when I can't sleep, I doodle. Please don't judge my work based on those.
I wasn't. Caleb's eyes cast about desperately, looking for an excuse for him to be in here. He settled on the bench full of robotics.
I was curious about the drones.
You're a nervous guy, Caleb.
I've noticed that about you, Seidel said, coming over to stand before him.
He jerked his thumb in Lucinda's direction and lowered his voice.
All my assistants are trained to keep an eye out for intellectual piracy, but don't let her intimidate you. I'm sure we've got nothing to fear from a member of Earth Guard, right, Lucinda?
Right,
Lucinda replied, barely even looking at Caleb anymore. She was on her phone, answering emails.
Piracy? No, I was just,
Caleb took a deep breath. Infiltration wasn't really his strong suit, apparently.
I was just bored, I guess. Hey! Mi casa es su casa,
Seidel replied. His eyes lit up, and he considered Caleb anew.
I'm a little busy right now with the whole groundbreaking spaceflight thing.
Oh, yeah. Congratulations, Caleb said hurriedly.
Thanks, Seidel replied. But hey, next time you're bored, I'd love to take a look at those legacies of yours. Maybe run a few tests. See what we can figure out. Duplication pretty much defies all known physics, right? I live for that stuff.
Oh. Caleb let his gaze slide to Seidel's sketches. The man seemed intent on figuring out how the Lorik ticked and how to stop them. Should Caleb really submit to some kind of tests? He couldn't think of a polite way to say no, and as the awkwardness between him and grinning Wade stretched on, he felt one of his duplicates nearly pop out from the anxiety. Caleb took a breath, steadied himself, and nodded in a way he hoped was casual.
Yeah, sure, Caleb said. Cool.
Cool,
Seidel repeated, slapping Caleb on the shoulder.
Lucinda, get something with my young friend here on the calendar.
Just like that, Seidel was leaving the room again, returning to his cocktail party. He shouted over his shoulder,
"The people in this house are going to change human existence! What a time to be alive!"
Chapter 26 Taylor Cook, Bayan Olzhgi Province, Mongolia.
You know, I was led to believe that life with the Foundation didn't suck, Taylor said, trying and failing to keep her teeth from chattering. There wasn't anything in the brochures about freezing my ass off in Russia. Mongolia, the woman on the video chat corrected. Whatever, Taylor replied.
She burrowed deeper into her parka, clutching the tablet with numb fingers, despite a pair of thick wool gloves.
It's -30 degrees here. I sincerely apologize for rushing you into your first assignment, the woman said.
She was the middle-aged lady with the chopped blonde hair, who Taylor had caught a brief glimpse of talking to Einar back in Iceland. Her name was B, allegedly. There was something vaguely familiar about her, but Taylor couldn't quite put her finger on it. Seeing the cozy fire and steaming mug of tea at Bee's location did little to improve Taylor's mood.
"Normally, we let our recruits enjoy the lifestyle the Foundation provides before asking them to fulfill a task. But you were needed urgently."
"Needed," Taylor repeated. "I don't even know what I'm doing here."
"Healing. That's all we'll ever ask you to do, Taylor. Save lives. Make them better."
Always the same Foundation propaganda, Taylor thought. The lady was like a broken record.
"Would you mind taking me through the events that led you to leave the Academy?" Bee asked. "In your own words."
Taylor raised an eyebrow.
"I already told you people everything. Indulge me."
So Taylor went through it all again. It helped that she didn't have to lie. She told Bee how Earthguard had taken Ran and Cupano, arrested them without charges for crimes that were actually self-defense. She talked about how Nigel had disappeared in London, and how Earthguard was keeping that information from them. She said she didn't trust the administration to keep her safe or look out for her best interests.
"Thank you, Taylor. Very enlightening," Bee said when Taylor was finished.
She glanced over her shoulder. Someone else was in the room with her, listening in, and flashed a self-satisfied smile in their direction.
"We'll be in touch soon."
The connection went dead. Immediately, the soldier standing watch over Taylor reached out and took the tablet away from her. They were even more strict here than at the Academy about communication with the outside world. That shouldn't have surprised her. She was part of an international conspiracy now. Taylor touched her forearm surreptitiously. Her key to getting out of this and hopefully bringing down the Foundation was hidden there. They'd done a full body scan on her the day after she left the Academy, but hadn't found it. Just like Malcolm Good had said, what she was carrying wouldn't set off any alarms. It couldn't be detected. Not until it was activated, at least. And for that, she would need to gain access to a phone. A week had gone by since Miki spirited her away from the Academy. He had dropped her on a boat where a couple of mercenaries disguised as fishermen were waiting. They'd been very polite about tranquilizing her. She'd woken up on a private airplane beside a red-headed woman with a faint Russian accent. She never introduced herself, but she was kind and deferential to Taylor. Even though the woman was just some Foundation go-between, Taylor tried to memorize her face. The Russian carried one of the tablet computers that Taylor soon learned most of the important Foundation people had, password protected and coded to their fingerprints, so it wouldn't be an easy thing to hack. The steward fed Taylor truffle French fries, while the redhead asked her questions.
"The Foundation will provide you with a private residence. Where would you like that to be?"
"Somewhere warm and tropical," Taylor answered. "Would a private island be too much to ask for?" The woman smirked.
"We have more private islands than we know what to do with. I see in your file that your father is a farmer in South Dakota. It's possible that we could slip him out of America."
"No," Taylor replied quickly. "He won't want to come. But could you help him? In other ways?" The woman nodded.
"Some investments will be placed in his name. Of course, I probably don't need to remind you that all of this is contingent on your continued cooperation."
"Of course," Taylor said, detecting the implicit threat in the woman's words, and smiling like she didn't mind.
"Where are we going, anyway?" "Ukraine," the woman replied.
That was the first hint Taylor got, that her private island would be a while in coming. From the tiny airfield in Ukraine, a helicopter had flown her here, 5 days ago, to the freezing edge of the middle of nowhere. The ride-in had been one of the most harrowing experiences of Taylor's life. The chopper buffeted back and forth by savage winds, snow flurries limiting visibility. They'd made it, and she'd been cold ever since. Wordlessly, her soldier chaperone led her out of the tent and the small radius of its struggling space heater. He was dark-eyed and bearded, maybe Middle Eastern, armed with an AK-47 assault rifle. Taylor had given up trying to communicate with any of the 100 soldiers stationed here. Even if they spoke English, which often wasn't the case, they were under strict instructions not to talk to her. They were a hodgepodge of nationalities, probably mercenaries, like the Blackstone guys she'd encountered in Iceland. Only the executive officer, the XO as he was called, a lean, blonde-haired South African in his early 50s, ever spoke to her, and that was usually to give her an order. Outside, the cold hit Taylor immediately, but at least the snow had stopped. She pulled her balaclava down to protect her face and then followed the soldier back to her tent. The mercenary encampment looked like something out of a sci-fi movie, like they'd colonized an alien world. 20 tents stood in a grid, a convoy of ATVs and jeeps parked around them, some concrete barriers erected at the edge of camp to cut the wind. Beyond that, there was nothing but hilly plains covered in pure white snow, with the occasional patch of brown scrub grass poking through. The sky today was big and blue, reminding her a bit of South Dakota.
"Weather reports say we got 3 days without any snow," said a guard posted in front of the XO's tent, his voice muffled by his own ski mask.
"You know what that means," his companion muttered. "They'll have us out there doing night work."
"Ah, Christ," the first one replied. "You're right.
At least it means we get out of here quicker."
Just because the guards weren't speaking to her didn't mean that Taylor had stopped listening. She still didn't know what they were up to out here, what the Foundation was after. Every day, half the detachment drove out somewhere over the western rise, not returning until sunset. That's when Taylor did her healing, when the men came back fatigued and sullen, and with ailments they weren't allowed to explain. She'd been looking for a chance to poke around ever since she'd gotten here. A night shift might be exactly the opportunity she'd been waiting for. It was hard enough to tell anyone apart during the days, with all the face masks and winter clothing. Under cover of darkness, Taylor thought she might have an even better chance to slip in with the soldiers unnoticed. Her silent escort brought Taylor back to her tent at the center of camp, where he nodded to the guard posted outside and left. Taylor glanced at the man standing watch and felt a pang of sympathy. Even his eyes, the only part of him she could see, looked cold. Taylor had wondered aloud on her first day in Mongolia why she was being guarded like a prisoner. Weren't they all on the same team? The XO had assured her that it was for her own protection. His people were disciplined, yes, but some had been on the frozen wasteland for months.
"You understand," he'd said. "Pretty teenagers bring trouble with them."
Taylor's skin had crawled then, and she hadn't asked any questions about her chaperones since. She would need to give them the slip tonight, though, if she wanted to see what the mercenaries were up to out here.
"Oh my God! Close the damn flap before we all catch pneumonia!"
Lost in thought as she entered her tent, Taylor was slow to seal out the elements, and thus earned a sharp rebuke from Tiao. Taylor had first met the slim Chinese healer in Saudi Arabia, where she'd been domineering, fashionable, and almost killed by Anar. Tiao didn't seem so chic and intimidating now, perpetually stuck in the same frumpy winter gear as Taylor. She hated this assignment, and made sure to keep the others as miserable as she was. "Calm down," Taylor replied, rubbing her hands together. "If you catch pneumonia, we'll just heal you." Their tent was far from the glamorous lifestyle that the Foundation promised its recruits. Three cots, a card table, a hot plate, and a stockpile of blankets and thermal underwear. The XO assured Taylor that they had one of the best working space heaters in the company, although that did little to chase away the perpetual chill.
"Jin," Zhao declared, ignoring Taylor's response to slap her cards on the table. "I win again, meat boy."
"It's meatball," Vincent corrected. "Please don't call me that."
"Which?"
"Either."
Dark-haired and pudgy, Vincent was the final part of the healer trio assigned to Mongolia. Unlike Zhao and Taylor, the Italian boy hadn't joined the Foundation willingly. He had been trained at the academy and promoted to Earth Guard before getting kidnapped by the Foundation last year and pressed into service. Now, he seemed perpetually on the verge of tears and always jumpy, although that could have been the shivering. Taylor had been looking for an opportunity to talk with him one-on-one, but Zhao or one of the guards was always around. Vincent fumbled the cards, trying to shuffle them.
"Play again?" he asked.
"No," Zhao replied, standing up from the table and stretching. "We'll have to work soon, and I'm tired of beating you."
She turned to Taylor.
"You talk to B? She say how long we'll be stuck out here?"
"No," Taylor replied, not bothering to hide her own disappointment. She wouldn't give me a straight answer.
"Typical," Zhao said. "You must be questioning your decision to come back to us."
"A few more weeks of this, and maybe I will," Taylor said, glancing at Vincent. "But the academy was terrible, too. You have no idea."
Vincent said nothing and simply looked away from Taylor, fiddling with his deck of cards. She thought maybe he would defend the academy, but Vincent was probably too broken for that. Maybe he'd come to like the Foundation lifestyle. They could promise a lot, that much Taylor knew. They could also blackmail and extort. Taylor wasn't sure whether Vincent was a sellout or a coward. Neither would be particularly useful to her.
"Well, for what it's worth, this is the worst assignment they've ever sent me on," Zhao said.
Taylor wondered how committed Zhao was to the Foundation's work. These little conversations helped her probe deeper into her companions, but they weren't revealing anything that would truly bring down the Foundation.
"Worse than when Einar got you shot and threw you through a window?" Taylor asked.
Zhao smirked and flexed her knee, remembering the fight back in the UAE.
"Please, that was nothing," she said. "I healed those wounds in 10 minutes and spent the night dancing with one of the prince's handsome bodyguards."
Taylor rolled her eyes. Before anything else could be said, they heard the rumble of trucks returning to camp. The mercenary convoy had returned. Zhao breathed a sigh out through her nose, the air turning to mist. Vincent stood up, put away his cards, and paced nervously.
"Here we go," Taylor said.
The soldiers came in three at a time, one for each healer. They set down their rifles at the entrance, then stripped off balaclavas and gloves and whatever other pieces of body armor were in the way of their injuries. And they were always injured. Or maybe damaged was the more accurate way to put it. Regardless, by Taylor's count, 50 went out each day, and without fail, 50 returned. A whole unit in need of healing. Soon the tent smelled like body odor and cigarettes. Vincent did his work in timid silence, but Zhao kept on a running monologue in Chinese, barking sharply at any soldier that tracked snow or mud into their tent. The tent was usually quiet except for Zhao's ravings. The soldiers didn't talk to the guard, and they rarely talked to each other. Taylor's first patient was a muscular Asian man who stared deferentially at the ground while she grasped his hands, healing the beginning of frostbite on his fingers. He had some deep cuts on his knee and shin. It looked like he'd fallen. She healed those, too. Then, she pressed her hands against the sides of his neck and healed the sickness. On their first day in Mongolia, Taylor had discerned that it wasn't just bumps and bruises that the Foundation wanted them to heal. It was the sickness, present in everyone who returned from the mysterious expedition site. Taylor had trained in hospitals while at the academy. She'd encountered the flu and strep throat, cancer, and a random case of smallpox. Even the Arab prince's late-stage leukemia that had taken 4 of them to heal. None of those maladies felt like this sickness. It was as if a darkness were growing in the soldiers. Taylor could sense tendrils of it when she used her legacy. She could swear that the illness fought back against her. Every day, she cleansed the soldiers' bodies of the sickness. And the next day, they came back. By her 4th soldier, Taylor wasn't cold anymore. Sweat shone on her forehead. A dislocated shoulder, more frostbite, cuts and scrapes, and always the sickness. What was out there that was infecting these men? What did the Foundation want with it? Taylor needed to find out.
"Hey, Taylor," Vincent spoke up, already sounding exhausted. "Could you help me out over here? This guy's real bad."
"Sure, one second," Taylor replied, finishing up with her own patient before stepping over to Vincent.
Taylor cringed when she saw the man standing in front of Vincent. He'd stripped down to his pants, pale skin nearly blue from the cold. His right side was entirely covered in dark burns, the skin cooked and blackened. Spreading out from that grievous wound were discolored black veins. He stood resolute, teeth gritted, like he wasn't in an incredible amount of pain.
"Cat bloody tells me it's bad," the soldier said, speaking out of turn in a thick Scottish accent. "What kind of bedside manner's that, eh?"
"Sorry," stammered Vincent. "How did this happen to you?" Taylor asked, as she pressed her hands to the Scotsman's burns, letting her healing energy slowly restore the skin. Next to her, she felt Vincent beating back the sickness. It was stronger in this guy than any of hers had been. She could actually see the black veins in his chest recede while they worked.
"Finally some goddamn action, that's how it happened," the soldier said.
"Shut up, McLaughlin,"
chided one of the other soldiers.
"You know the rules."
"What?"
McLaughlin exclaimed innocently, eyeing Taylor as she tended to him.
"The pretty American lass wants to hear some war stories. Who am I to deny her?"
Just then, the XO poked his head into the tent, a steely glare aimed in McLaughlin's direction.
"McLaughlin!"
the XO shouted, sounding good-natured, in the same way Professor Nine did right before he ordered you to run laps around the campus.
"Did all hear you volunteering to do a double?"
McLaughlin gritted his teeth.
"Aye, boss," he said, deadpan. "Can't wait to get back out there."
"Great,"
the XO looked at Taylor.
"That's enough healing then, my dear. He'll be back in here tomorrow morning."
Taylor and Vincent both stepped back from McLaughlin, his burns only half healed, the black veins still creeping up his ribcage.
"Sorry," Taylor murmured.
"No worries," McLaughlin replied with a wink. "I'll rub some ice on it. Plenty of that, eh?"
The rest of that day's healing passed without incident. Afterward, they were brought what amounted to a feast on the dreary tundra. Stale pumpernickel bread, canned oranges, a tasteless hard cheese, and sausage from a mystery animal. Of course, they all wolfed it down, even if Jiao did so while holding her nose. Healing that many people was exhausting work and left them all starving. Taylor felt the exhaustion creeping in, the emptiness inside her from too much healing, the tingling in her fingers from overusing her legacy. It was the same as every day since she'd been here. Wake up, freeze, heal, eat, sleep.
She needed to break that pattern tonight. If only she could stay awake. After dinner, Vincent yawned and stumbled to his cot.
Man, I can't believe we have to do that again tomorrow morning.
Whatever gets us out of here quicker, Zhao replied.
She snorted.
Don't know what you're whining about anyway. Taylor and I do way more work than you.
Taylor made no comment, although it was true. Vincent definitely didn't have the same abilities that she and Zhao had. Or at least, he wasn't pushing himself as hard. Maybe he'd been promoted too quickly from the academy. Or maybe this was Vincent's small act of rebellion against the Foundation. Taylor didn't know. The days were short in Western Mongolia, and night came on quickly. All three guard were soon snuggled into their heavy-duty sleeping bags. Taylor had been assured by the XO that they were the same kind used by climbers when they summited Everest. They all shifted in unison, grumbling as they tried to get comfortable on their rock-hard cots. The healers didn't talk to each other, and Taylor found herself missing the camaraderie of the academy. Taylor wormed her hand up her sweater and clutched the amulet Kopano had made for her, relieved that the Foundation people hadn't taken it away. She wondered where Kopano was at that moment. She hoped he and the others were okay. The rest of the camp was still alive. The mercenaries talked loudly in a variety of languages, eating and drinking, cleaning their guns, playing cards. The wind howled. Taylor tried to keep her eyes open, waiting for a sign that the soldiers were going out on their night mission. She snapped awake at the sound of revving engines, and one mercenary yelling at another to get his ass in gear.
Damn it!
She dozed off. The soldiers were already moving out. She would need to get going quickly if she wanted to slip into their midst. Taylor glanced in Zhao and Vincent's direction. They were both sleeping, Vincent even snoring gently. The soldiers outside were noisy as hell, but after a non-stop healing session, the guard could probably sleep through the apocalypse. Taylor's whole body ached from the cold and the exertion as she pushed herself to get out of bed. She couldn't just keep sitting around and doing the Foundation's bidding. She needed to do something. Find out what they were up to out here at the ass end of nowhere. Taylor crept toward the entrance of their tent and slowly undid the zipper enough to peek through. As usual, there was a guard posted up right outside, but he was too distracted by the convoy of mercenaries leaving to notice her. Still, she would need a distraction to get by him. With her telekinesis, Taylor reached out and began unmooring the metal pylons from the tent nearest to hers. When they were loose enough, she waited for a strong gust of wind. Those were never long in coming out here, and then gave the tent as firm a telekinetic shove as she could muster. The shelter went flying, exposing a half-dozen soldiers sleeping within. Immediately, they started shouting and scrambling, flinging themselves out of bed to grab their flying tent. Just as Taylor hoped, the soldier watching the guard's tent left his posting to go help. Taylor slipped into the night. She pulled her balaclava over her face and tried to puff herself up, walking like a man. No one paid her any attention. She speed-walked towards the headlights of the departing convoy. Of course, Taylor knew this was dangerous. Maybe a little crazy, like something Isabella might do.
"Act confident," Isabella had told her once, "and you can bullshit your way through any situation."
She leaned on that wisdom now. She also reasoned that no matter what she did out here, short of revealing herself as a spy, the Foundation wouldn't let anything happen to her. She was too valuable. Men all around her were climbing into trucks and driving into the night. Steeling herself, Taylor picked a random SUV and climbed into the back seat. She cringed immediately. The SUV she'd chosen was empty, except for the driver, who was giving her a weird look in the rearview mirror. And the driver was McLaughlin.
"The hell you sitting back there for?" he asked her. "I don't got cooties."
Taylor made a noncommittal grunting sound and slouched. Maybe he'd think she was one of the mercenaries who didn't speak English, tired and grumpy from having to do night work.
"I know the feeling," McLaughlin replied with a snort.
It had worked. He started to put the truck in gear, but then paused and looked at Taylor again.
"You forget something, you git."
She stared blankly at him. He patted the M16 attached to a rack along the truck's middle.
"Your weapon, dingus! Where's your weapon?"
Taylor winced. It hadn't even occurred to her to steal one of the rifles. She didn't know what to say, and now McLaughlin was really looking at her.
"Take your hat off," he ordered.
Swallowing, Taylor did as she was told. McLaughlin's eyes lit up immediately.
"Ah, the curious gal," he said, amused.
He twisted around in his seat to eyeball her, wincing thanks to the burns that Taylor hadn't finished healing.
"You think this is a trip to the mall or something?"
"I want to see why I'm out here freezing my ass off," Taylor replied honestly, trying to sound self-assured. "Take me with you, and I'll finish healing you."
McLaughlin stared at her for a moment. Then he shrugged and awkwardly unbuckled his body armor so that Taylor could reach her hands inside.
"Fuck it," he said. "XO finds out you tricked me with some alien magic, yeah?"
"Yeah."
McLaughlin put the truck in drive and followed the line of vehicles out into the darkness of the plains. Taylor leaned forward and pressed her hands against his side, healing him while he drove.
"This reminds me of the time I stole my dad's car to dog it with Betty Garrity," McLaughlin said with a laugh.
Taylor recoiled a bit.
"Don't get any ideas," she warned. "I could throw you through that windshield in a heartbeat."
"Ah, don't flatter yourself, little miss," McLaughlin snorted. "I got a wife and kids at home, and you're all a 12 years old."
They drove in silence after that. Eventually, Taylor finished healing McLaughlin and leaned back in her seat, peering out the window. It was pure darkness out there. The convoy drove in a straight line, headlights illuminating only the truck in front of them, and what seemed like endless snow and ice. They were traveling uphill, cresting the western rise, going no more than 20 miles per hour as they rumbled across the slippery terrain.
"What's out there?" Taylor asked,
growing impatient after 30 minutes spent driving in a straight line. McLaughlin smirked.
"Better you see it yourself. Almost there."
Indeed, Taylor saw lights up ahead. Not lights from a town, but flood lamps mounted on towering girders, like at a construction site. A crane came into view, and some kind of heavy-duty drill that reminded Taylor of an oil derrick. Still, she couldn't see what all that equipment was for. Not until they reached the top of the rise and started heading downhill. Taylor leaned forward in her seat, eyes wide.
"It's a warship," she said.
The wreckage of one of the vast Mogadorian warships was spread out across the snowy valley. Even half destroyed, the city block-sized ship was ominous. Clearly, where it hadn't been blown apart, it had been scavenged, chunks missing here and there, other sections dissected. It looked to Taylor like the skeleton of a giant metal locust.
"Aye," McLaughlin replied. "And the thing leaks like a son of a bit."
Before he could finish, a streak of red energy cut through the darkness and sizzled into the passenger side of the truck in front of them. McLaughlin slammed on the brakes, narrowly avoiding the other truck as it skidded out of control.
"Hell!"
McLaughlin shouted. He pulled on a pair of night vision goggles and grabbed for his rifle.
I thought we killed all these bloody vermin earlier.
Taylor stared out her window. You mean...
Nasty bastards are out there, freezing their alien balls off, McLaughlin answered. Stragglers come through every once in a while. Probably mad we're going through their stuff, you know. Only a few of them. Nothing we can't...
McLaughlin trailed off as he looked through the goggles. The entire convoy had stopped, mercenaries taking cover behind their trucks, assuming defensive positions.
But more than a handful, McLaughlin breathed.
He shoved Taylor.
Get your arse down!
Even as he did, the night lit up crimson. 100 streaks of blaster fire sizzled across the plain, bombarding the convoy from both sides. The windows of their truck shattered, and Taylor felt a blistering sensation on her cheek, smelled her hair burning. McLaughlin let out a cry, and was suddenly silent. They were under attack. There were Mogadorians on the tundra. Chapter 27 Kopano Okeke, Abu Dhabi, the United Arab Emirates. A cupcake inside a box, covered in barbed wire. That's all it was. Simple as that. Kopano stared at himself in the dusty mirror. His face was dappled with sweat, and not just from the dry heat of the Persian Gulf. The cafe bathroom was tiny, dimly lit, and smelled like hookah smoke. He wiped a smudge off the mirror with his shirt sleeve, as if being able to see himself clearly would make this easier.
Okay, he told himself. Just like the cupcake. Cupcake. No big deal.
The barbed wire box and the tasty treat inside had been one of Professor Nine's favorite training games when they first learned Kopano could spread his molecules as well as harden them. It required him to keep part of his arm transparent while his solid hand reached for the cupcake. Rest assured, Dr. Good told him once, while it'll take time to master your legacy, it is part of your biology now. Your body won't let you hurt yourself. It won't let you solidify your arm when it's sharing the same quantum space with the box, in the same way that your lungs won't let you hold your breath forever. Kopano really, really wanted to believe that. He leaned close to the mirror and peered at the tiny wound on his temple. The bandage had come off a couple of days ago, leaving behind a glued-shut incision the same size as his little fingernail. The scab would probably come off in a couple of days and leave behind a barely noticeable scar. But obviously, it wasn't the cut that concerned Kopano. It was what was underneath. The chip. The one that gave Agent Walker and her people control. Kopano pressed his index finger against the side of his head, turned the digit transparent, and then slowly, cautiously, pushed his finger into his cranium. There was a strange, fizzy sensation at the side of his head. He started to see spots, and immediately yanked his finger out. He waited a moment, hands braced on the sides of the sink, to see if he would have an aneurysm or something. There was a mild throb around his incision, maybe the beginning of a headache, but nothing Kopano couldn't handle.
You're okay, he reassured his reflection. You can do this. Just like the cupcake.
What took you so long? Agent Walker asked when Kopano emerged from the cafe.
She leaned against their rented town car, aviator sunglasses glinting in the late afternoon sun.
Sorry, Kopano replied. He rubbed his belly. I got used to American food, where they don't use any spices.
Walker made a face.
Ah, condolences. You want to drive?
Without waiting for a response, she tossed Kopano the car keys. They climbed into the air-conditioned sedan where Ran waited, stoic and silent in the back seat.